of the full House Committee on Education. We'll have first a public hearing on House Bill 3187. And will you tell us about that bill? We now open a public hearing on House Bill 3187.
House Bill 3187 requires district boundary board to give school districts affected by proposed boundary change or merger opportunity to present arguments in favor of or against change or merger. Allows district boundary board to deny petition or request for a change or merger if boards finds that the change or merger would have negative impact on affected school districts. Declares an emergency effective on passage.
Yes, and first we'll hear from John Marshall, Oregon School Board Association.
Mr. Chairman.
Hello, John.
Members of the committee, good afternoon. John Marshall, representing the Oregon School Boards Association. Before you get into the substance of House Bill 3187, I thought it might be helpful for you to try to put this particular issue in context of the overall statutory scheme that the legislature has established for both mergers of school districts as well as boundary changes. It's a reading the statute, it's a complex process. There are a number of steps. And I think in consideration of House Bill 3187 and the extent to which it imposes an additional step might be a little bit helpful, I think helpful for you to understand that. School district mergers and boundary changes are guided by the procedure set forth in ORS Chapter 330. In that procedure, the ESD board, that is the board, the ESD in which the school districts that are either going to be affected by a merger or boundary change are located, the board of that ESD serves in a capacity as the boundary board. And the membership doesn't change. It's still the board. It's still an open meeting and following all those rules. It's just that they serve a purpose under Chapter 330 as the boundary board. School district boards or citizens that seek to merge school districts or to simply change the boundaries of a school district have to go through the boundary board to start that process. And in order to start that process, the boundary board, in short, needs the paperwork. So there are two ways in which the boundary board can consider a merger or a boundary change. The first is under a request of the affected school district boards. Two school districts decide they want to merge. The boards take a request to the boundary board, and it has some legal requirements in terms of boundary descriptions and so forth. But that's one way to get that issue before the boundary board. The other is a citizen petition. If citizens want to merge two school districts, they may bring a petition. If citizens want to move property from one school district to another, they can bring that issue to the boundary board by a petition. And that petition has to be signed by 500 or 5% of the registered voters in each of the affected school districts, whichever's less. 5% or 500, whichever's less. Those requests go to the boundary board. The boundary board, by statute, is required to give notice of the meeting at which they will hear that issue, and then folks can appear before them, state their piece. What's significant, I think, about this process is that under current law, the boundary board has absolutely no decision-making authority. They can't say yes. They can't say no. They can say they think it's a good idea. They can say they think it's a bad idea. But in terms of a legal function, they have none other than to hold that meeting. At that meeting, then the law says they are required to order that change. Whether it comes from the affected school district boards or citizen petitions, they have to order that change. Once that change is ordered, then there opens an opportunity for anybody that objects, that is citizens that object, to file a remonstrance. And all a remonstrance is a petition. And again, that petition is signed by 500 of the registered voters, or 5%, whichever is less, of the registered voters in either of the affected school districts. So on the chart, after those requests or petitions go to the boundary board, if no remonstrance is filed, that's on the right-hand side of your chart, the boundary board orders the change, and it's a done deal. If a remonstrance is filed, that is, if a petition objecting to the merger or boundary change is turned in, then that sends the issue to an election. And it's only an election that's held in the district from which the petition came. So it doesn't require an election on both sides for a boundary change or a merger, only one. If the election in that district passes, then it goes back to the boundary board, and the boundary board orders that boundary change or merger. If the election fails, then a similar boundary change or merger cannot be brought back before the boundary board for a year. Now, there are folks here from Jervis School Districts that will talk to you about an experience they've had with citizens wanting to move pieces of property from their school district into another school district. And what House Bill 37 does is to allow the boundary board to hear arguments on both sides of the issue and then make a decision about whether or not the boundary change or the merger will go forward. There are circumstances, obviously, where everybody maybe disagrees with the boundary change, and that the boundary board would say, well, yeah, we certainly don't want to stand in the way of what everybody wants to do, and they would allow it to go forward. There are circumstances where they may say, well, we think this is a terrible idea, and we don't want it to go forward, so we'll stand up and not allow it. Obviously, when you give the boundary board that level of decision-making authority, that's putting them into a very interesting circumstance. For example, two school district boards decide for the interest of students to create greater efficiency in the spending of the school district dollars. They want to merge. It's in the best interest, they believe, of the students, and both boards have come together and agreed. And this is what happened, by the way, down in North Douglas County, where both boards agreed that Yonkala and North Douglas ought to merge because in two small school districts, relatively close, they only needed one high school. Both boards agreed. A remonstrance was filed that sent it to an election in both districts. In one district, it passed, and then the other district, it failed. And it failed, I believe, because of some citizens' concern. We've always had a high school in our community here in Drain, and we don't want it down in Yonkala. Now, while the boards thought that was a good idea, it would have probably been in the best interest of students, some folks in the community, long-standing citizens in the community, said no. So by putting the boundary board into a position of making decisions, there are some where there's probably broad agreement about a decision the boundary board would make, and there are other decisions that wouldn't be as broad. So in the context of the overall procedure, that's where House Bill 3187 lies. And with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Yes, and let me, if you don't mind, Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Marshall, I'm looking at is this diagram that we have the existing process?
Yes.
Okay. Now, if they're under the proposed process, if the boundary board said no, could the voters still go ahead and approve it themselves or with a petition?
The way I read House Bill 3187, no. They could not.
Okay. That seems like a problem to me, but thank you.
Any other questions?
Just a couple, Mr. Marshall. When was the last boundary change updated? Do you know? When was the last boundary board authority changed? I assume, with your wisdom, that you know just about everything, and I thought this would be an easy one, John. 2 years ago? Was it two?
The record.
I'm sorry, two sessions ago? It hasn't been long this process has been worked over.
I recall some significant changes that were made I believe it in the mid-80s. And there were some modifications made after the legislature's action in 1991 that would cause mandated school districts to be unified. There were some provisions in the boundary change statute regarding elections that if the legislature is going to mandate it, it doesn't make much sense for folks to go through an election, turn down a school district consolidation issue, and then have to do it anyhow because the legislature mandated it. But I believe that the last time any fundamental change was probably 20 years ago, 15 to 20 years ago.
Thank you very much.
Any questions?
Yes. Representative Lamb.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. In the bill, House Bill 3187, it says that the line 11, if the district boundary board finds that the proposed change or merger would have a negative impact on the affected school district. What does it mean? Do you know the negative impact? We're talking about the financial impact or...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lim, it would seem to me that's a finding that of the boundary board. And the boundary board would have to state the way in which they measure that negative impact. So it's in direct response to your question, I think negative impact means whatever the boundary board finds it to mean.
Okay.
It could be financial. It could be an impact on students or student transportation or school programs. I think it's a variety of things.
So to follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So it looks like this bill has a veto power. Anything shows the negative impact, then that's it.
And certainly the proponents of Senate Bill 3187 will be here, and I believe that's the intent.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Marshall? If not, thank you again, John. Larry Blaze.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Larry Glaze. I'm the superintendent of Jervis School District. I am very much in favor of this House bill. We, as a school district, recently went through a boundary change. And our experience has been one of frustration, and that's the reason that we got involved with this House bill coming to you. And so I'd like to share with you a little bit of our experiences so you can see how this statute works with a school district and hopefully be able to convince you that there is a need for another step prior to it going to the voters. Our experience with this, I guess I'll just cut to the chase. I'd like to share with you the findings and order of the Willamette Education Service District after the hearing. This was their finding. And this is the criteria that this decision was made on for changing about 10 families, 10 parcels out of our district into another district. And this is the criteria that was used for that decision at the board level. The petition was accompanied by 154 signatures of electors of Jervis School District. That was the first criteria. Second criteria, the petition was supported by 573 signatures of electors of Silver Falls School District. The third criteria, Marion County Clerk has certified the signatures on the petitions as effective. Fifth, the petitions were supported by maps showing the proper tracts and the legal descriptions. And fifth, the petitioners proposed the proportionate share of assets and liabilities of Jervis School District to be transferred to Silver Falls School District. So basically, when we went to the hearing for this issue, that was the sole criteria for the decision as to whether those parcels would be moved out of our school district into another school district. Now, we did have the opportunity to provide input at the hearing, but the input was moot. Our voice was not heard in terms of the impact that this had on our school district. I guess I would submit to you as a body the fact that negative impact may be somewhat of a subjective judgment, but that this is a permanent change to a school district, and that it shouldn't be just based on straightforward criteria that, that a clerk could establish. I'm not sure that a board needs to be looking at whether or not this paperwork has been done. We lost from our school district $1.7 million worth of assessed value. The negative impact for our school district, of course, was the fact that not just the loss of the assessed value, but the loss of taxing capacity. In our school district, for example, we have a middle school that was built in the 30s. It's long beyond its life. We need to build a new school. We've had some difficulty raising a bond through elections. With this, what happens is that it erodes the tax base so that as these properties leave our district, then the residents of Jervis School District now have a higher tax rate to approve for a new building. So that of course, is a negative impact. The other negative impact is that we're losing 10 parcels, 10 families, a number of students, and that's a permanent change. And as you well know, as you lose students, you're losing state dollars. And so you're losing income to support the existing students that remain in your school district. Those were some issues for us. It was frustrating for us to go through the process and realize that although we were invited to the hearing, there was really no cause for us to come, because nothing we had to say had a bearing on a decision that was made. Now, I know that the argument is made that certainly that's not a problem, because you can always file a remonstrance and you can take it to a vote. Let the voters decide. Well, that did happen in our district. The petition was supported by 55 votes in our school district. What it happened in our school district, in our case, was we had a highly organized group of people who put this petition forward. They were very effective in sending literature out into the community, much of it critical of the school board that exists. The process, needless to say, was very disruptive to the school district at the time. The district was not in a position to put together an opposition group to fight this in terms of the political aspects of it. And so this boundary issue went in favor of the group that petitioned to leave the school district. The election is costly for a school district. It's not a cheap thing to do. At the end of the process, once the election went through and it was successful, we were also left with the cost of putting together a resolution. This is not something that people are knowledgeable about. It took a considerable amount of legal time to get this done, but we had to do a resolution for the division of assets and liabilities. And that was an interesting process to go through, but it also cost us a lot of money as a school district. So these things are not without their expenses to a school district as well. I guess the reason that I am supportive of this is that it does give the ESD Boundary Board some decision-making capacity, some judgment in a decision that is a permanent decision, a decision that is a change and a change forever. And that at any important decision that we make like that should entail some degree of human judgment. It shouldn't be just based on criteria that a clerk could establish. And the other point that I would make that I think is a real problem with the way that the system works is that the petitioners have as much time as they need to put together the proper signatures, make sure that they've got everything just the way it should be before it's taken in. You're given, as a school district, 20 days for your citizens to put together a remonstrance and get it in. Again, that's a real challenge unless you're set up politically in your community to do that. Okay. Now, I know probably one of the issues that may come up here today is the issue that this is an automatic no. And I guess I would disagree with that. Because what the language says is, the district boundary board shall give each school district affected by the proposed change or merger an opportunity to present to the board arguments in favor of or against the proposed change or merger. If the boundary board finds that the proposed change or merger would have a negative impact on the affected school district, the district boundary board shall deny the request or petition. Now, in my mind, as I read that, there is room for judgment. It's not automatic. Yes, there is some decision-making in terms of what is a negative impact. I submit to you that there probably should be. This is a permanent change. There should be some human judgment that falls into place.
Yes, Representative March.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in trying to get to that point of what a negative impact would be, any loss of any value could be perceived as a negative impact on a district. So are we going to quantify that? For example, you lost $1.7 million in assessed value. What percentage of your total assessed value did that represent?
That's a fairly small percentage. I don't have that percent right at hand, but
less than 10?
Yes, less than 10%. Yes. The issue again with that is that if you have a district like ours in Jervis, where we are surrounded by other districts, so all of our properties are right up against different districts, you do have the potential for the fringes of your school district being eaten away. And I think that's also a concern that we have here in having another step in the process. I don't know if I answered your question.
Follow-up, Representative.
Yeah, well then, I have two follow-ups. In terms of percentage, number of students, what percentage of students did that represent? And then, since this appears as though if the school ESD found there was a negative impact and said no, what appeals process would you give to the public? Because this doesn't have one.
I think it does. I think they have the opportunity to come back in 12 months and try it again.
Any other questions?
I have one question.
Yes, Representative Lim.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. As I read the bill, when they try to merge it together, one district always finds some kind of a negative impact, no matter what. And so with this bill, no district shall be able to merge it together, either for good or bad. And how do you comment on that one?
Well, I don't know. I don't have any... Representative Lim, I don't have a specific example for you in terms of districts that have merged that have agreed to that process. I mean, I guess what I'm getting at is I do think that's possible for that to happen if two districts, two boards, two superintendents feel that that would be the process that would be in the best interest of both districts. I mean, it's not out of the realm of possibility for that to happen. How likely, I can't address that. I see your point. I see the issue that you're making.
Thank you.
Any other questions? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm going to ask that I see that there are four of you from Jervis, and you're all in favor of this petition. If it's appropriate, I'll ask you to come to the podium together. And if you And that's Deborah Hollum, Michelle Patton, Linda Wanberg, and Maria Capello?
Capello.
Thank you very much. And I think we can get a fourth chair in there if we're careful. I want to tell you, if the idea that you want to express is not stated, we'll give you plenty of time to get that done. But if one of you can carry the coal for all of you, that would be somewhat expedient. And for the record, if you'd state your name when you speak.
Mr. Chair and Committee, I'm Michelle Patton. I'm an 8th grade language arts teacher in the Jervis School District. I'm also the president of the Jervis Education Association, so I'm kind of speaking more from a teaching standpoint. Maria Caballero is a member of our school board. Deb Holland is a parent, a very active parent in our community. And Linda Warburg is our director of special services. She would like to speak to you from a special ed standpoint after I get finished, if that's okay.
Surely.
We work in a small school district, live in a small school district. Children attend a small school district. We have about 1,200 students in our district. I personally, as the only 8th grade language arts teacher, get to see every 8th grader that comes through our system. And I enjoy that. The same thing happens for our 7th and 8th grade social studies teacher, science teacher, math teacher, a lot of other people in our building. We see this as a large advantage to being in a small school. I believe there are a lot of advantages to being in a small school. I get to know entire families as siblings from the same family cycle through my classroom. I've had some families where I've had 4 or 5 kids come through, and I know these families on a very personal basis. Parents feel very welcomed into our small buildings. School events become true community gatherings, and students often attend school and are in the same classes with the same students clear from kindergarten through high school, which allows them to form very strong bonds. Also, having the small district allows us to keep class sizes smaller, which we all know is a good thing for kids. Despite all of these benefits, though, I believe that our district and other small districts like it are in jeopardy. Recently, as you've heard from Mr. Glaze, a group of property owners who, I might add, never gave us a chance to educate their children, never became involved in our school district in any way, requested that they be legally allowed to transfer their children out of our district. When that request was denied by the board, they decided to go through the process with the ESD and have their property transferred into the adjacent school district, which is Silver Falls. Under the current law, all they had to do was collect the correct number of signatures, file the right paperwork, and the request was approved. As Mr. Glaze said, at no time was the impact on our district ever considered. We lost $1.7 million worth of property value, and with economics the way they are right now, we just can't take anything like that lightly. But beyond the money, the boundary change indicated a much larger problem for us as a small district. As soon as that transfer was approved, more requests began coming into our school board to transfer more students out. The property owners said, if you don't approve this, we will also go to the ESD. We will also request to have the boundaries changed. One individual, in fact, even inquired at the ESD as to the process for forcing our district to merge with Salem-Keizer. As you've heard, again, that process would have been all he would have to do is get the right number of signatures, file the right paperwork, and it would have set that in motion. As our borders shrink inward, we're losing not only money but diversity in our student population. Right now, we are a very diverse population. Many of the property owners asking to leave our district are doing so for reasons that have less to do with academics and more to do with race. It is true that under the current law, the community that property owners ask to leave can file a remonstrance, and our community did that. A team led by Mrs. Holum filed the remonstrance, got it put on the ballot. But as Mr. Glaze said, the property owners that wanted out had large financial resources, and we had very little. Our voters were not educated as to what this would mean in the long run for our district, and it passed by a very, very narrow margin of 54 votes. If the changes in House Bill 3871 are approved, we would have the power then, if similar requests come up again, to have our to have the impact on our district considered. I believe it's vitally important that the governing agencies be required to take into account any and all repercussions of boundary change and merger requests, whether they're positive or negative. Without consideration of the impact on districts, I believe that smaller school districts could eventually fold as their borders are chipped away and resources and students are lost. I have no desire to see small districts swallowed up by larger districts around them, but I fear that is precisely what will happen if we continue to allow boundary changes based solely on the petitioner's ability to gather signatures and fill out paperwork properly. If governing agencies were given the mandate to consider the impact boundary changes and mergers would have on the districts, I believe that the process would be made more fair and equitable, and that small districts would be given a fighting chance to maintain those things that are important to us. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we'll hold our questions until we hear from all of you.
Sure.
Would you turn the microphone a little bit that way?
Yeah.
I do have a playground voice, but I'll be glad to use the microphone. Representative and Chair and Representative, I'd like to speak to you today from the specific standpoint of what you were addressing, Representative Lim, about a negative impact.
For the record, would you state your name?
Oh, Linda Warburg, Director of Special Services in the Jervis School District. One of the hats that I wear there is the Director of Special Education. And when you look at the opportunity to express my opinion today, I appreciate this because it is very vital to the survival of small school districts. In particular, our ability to serve special needs children can be disproportionately affected by the gain or losses of property as relatively minor changes in funding hit us the hardest. For the ESD board to be empowered to not only hear but to act on this negative impact is a vital concern. If my district, for example, was the receiving district of the boundary change property, and in that, the children that came, there were a number of significantly disabled students, the impact to my district would be phenomenal. Given the fact that students and the funding is already shorter than what is needed, special needs students, the funding will not follow them directly because the number of students that a district can have in their special education funding is limited by a cap of 11%. Additional students doesn't mean additional dollars. So when that negative impact is that services for a child with multiple disabilities can cost the district several times the allotment received for that student. So to me, as a special education director, to share with you, when a boundary change, especially if it adds special needs students to a small district, that district needs the opportunity to present potential negative impacts that the boundary change could present. Currently, the ones that hear are not empowered on any negative impacts, so that no one is aware of the ramifications of the boundary change. This bill will provide that forum for this to occur. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I want to add, when this boundary change was submitted to Willamette ESD, I'm Deb Holum. I'm a parent and a coach for Jervis School District, and I have two children attending Jervis schools right now. Jervis was faced with a devastating dilemma that the Willamette ESD board's hands were completely tied by law. This action could only be taken in regards to these petitions was to make sure that the appropriate paperwork was filed, both on their end and on our end. I attended the hearing as a parent representative, knowing what was going on in the district. Had I not been at that meeting, had I not left with the minutes from that meeting and gone straight to the elections office and filed that remonstrance, it would have been a done deal. Our parents would not have known. It had gone silently away, and the only way that they'd have heard about the negative impact, as I see, the loss of students, of property, and character in our district, it would have been reported in the newspaper silently. This is done. It's a done deal. However, with the remonstrance, we had an opportunity to speak up. What negatively impacted our group fighting against it was the fact that the petitioners were able to report to the media, the newspaper, whoever would listen, that Willamette ESD supported their move by voting yes that they could move on with this. They can publicly claim that because it did happen. Their hands were tied. They had no other options. Their options were, is the paperwork complete? Yes, it is. Whether it is a good thing or a bad thing, it is irrelevant to the fact that you did your footwork. It's done. So the community hears the message that Willamette ESD is in support of this boundary change. Why would we not think it was a good thing if our own if a board has heard this and says yes? So we as a community lose by 55 votes, and this property is gone because what we hear, the message that we hear is they said they approved it. Why shouldn't we? A statement made by the superintendent of Willamette ESD, Maureen Casey, as reported in the newspaper, was as follows. Mrs. Casey was said to express strong concern about the move to dismantle the Jervis School District. There could potentially be some very strong economical impacts on the Jervis School District, impacts that I do not think the voters understood in the last election. Superintendent Casey also stated she considered the boundary disputes taking place around the state as a very disturbing direction to the stability of the K-12 program. And that is because we can't get our message heard that it does matter. It does matter that when you bring a petition before a board, it stops there. If your paperwork's done, the board has nothing to do but to say yes. The only time that they can say no is if your paperwork's not done, and then they can just go back, correct that paperwork, and bring it back, and their hands are still tied. Because of this mixed message that the voters were allowed to change, we lost $1.7 million in property. That seems small and fractional compared to if you're going to ask for the percentages. However, immediately more families petitioned for their property to be removed. And as stated by Evan Sweat, one of the petitioners in writing, to dismantle this district piece by piece is his threat to our district. He will continue to fight until he is dismantled our district. His threat was that he is now pulling from the Salem-Kaiser area, and he is going to bring 20 families. If those 20 families are turned down, he will bring 40 families. This is in an email that he wrote. If we don't make a change, it's going to continue, and I just strongly urge that you consider this bill to give at least Willamette ESD a voice and option. So that when we bring our petition in and we're against what's going on, at least they have an option to hear and make at least a verbal statement instead of nothing. I'm sorry, but my hands are tied. Thank you very much.
Question now, you want to wait for the final test?
Oh,
I was going to say,
I think we have one more person to
share.
I'm sorry.
If you'll hold your question, if not,
absolutely will, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, and the members of the committee, my name is Maria Caballero, and I'm with the Jervis School District. I'm also a parent and involved in the school district. I'm a part of the board member, and I have a child in the school district. I also wanted to conclude in there that not only is a dilemma for the school district, but there's families that, you know, children that are in our school district that were the families that decided to move their properties, they have rentals. And some of our children that attend our schools, they are, you know, renting these homes. And so they were devastated, and they were, you know, they said, we don't want to move. So, you know, that's also a dilemma that, you know, you need to, hopefully you can consider, you know, that the Willamette ESD will have a voice, you know, because not it only hurts the district, but it also hurts the families that, you know, they're migrant workers or whoever, that they're renting their homes. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any questions? Yes, Representative Mark.
Yeah, thank you. With regard to the last issue, it seems to me that if there are rentals, it's the whoever's registered to vote there, if they're registered to vote. It doesn't say property owners, I don't think. So I will check that. But The other question is, you talked about giving the ESD, in this case, a voice. Would you consider a process whereby the ESD could say no, and the other side could do a remonstrance, get the registered voters, and go through the election side as well? In other words, a kind of an equalizing of that balance. Is that a fair question?
Well, in my personal opinion, I think that any type of added action that has to happen is positive. At this point, there's no action. And so any kind of input so that there would be more movement inside Willamette ESD with it than none.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? If not, thank you very much
thank
for taking
you.
The time to come in. And finally, Ozzy Rose.
Mr. Chairman of the Committee, for the record, I'm Ozzy Rose. I reside at 1323 Jordan Drive South in Salem, and I'm representing the Oregon Association of Education Service Districts, and we are here to oppose this bill. And our issue, we are very sympathetic to the arguments that Jervis put forward, and but the change that you're proposing really puts the board in the same position on the other side, because if a group of citizens come and want to change their boundary or move or whatever they'd request, and they come to the board with the paperwork, which is perfunctory now, I acknowledge, but then the affected district comes and says there's a negative impact because we lost $1.7 million and we lost 14 kids at $5,000 a kid, then the board has no decision other than to agree with turning it down. They have no real decision. The decision-making tilts now the other way, because it is very easy in our funding system to show a negative financial impact because we're funded on a per-student basis, and you guys underfund this overall. And so now you're in a position, I've been, in addition to being, this is a little toy I threw in, if you don't mind. In addition to being underfunded, we lose 10 kids at $50,000. That's a teacher. If there's been a negative impact, and if there's a negative impact, we shall deny the request. So the board believe they're in a position of the citizens have made their effort, and they have no way to respond to the, except no. Because it says, if there's a...
I can't hear that.
It shall, what?
If you'd have just sat tight, I can't hear it.
Oh. Shall deny the request. I'll answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Rose?
Okay, yes. Mr. Chair, thank you. Well, as drafted here, I think that is a problem, because always somebody's got a negative impact. If we put it to the board shall...
I heard that one on. Gotta have a dollar.
May deny based on some sort of decision process, you know, weighing the pros and the cons, and then have a process for winners or the losers, you know. So if they grant it, the losers can petition. If they don't grant it, the losers can petition the other losers. So would that satisfy the ESDs, you think?
I was responding to this language. They may, you know, it's one of those deals where you may look out, you may get what you wish for.
Exactly.
But the process you're outlining makes more sense.
Okay.
I agree. I you know, either way, it is not very rational to have just a system in which you take to your board some paperwork and they have no, you know, that's the testimony. I said a clerk could do this. On the other hand, if the decision is so structured that the board isn't going to have any real decision making, that doesn't make any sense either.
Okay.
Yeah. And I don't know enough about the merger process to how far we delve into changing that. Your question earlier, Mr. Chair, about when's the last time we changed it. I think it takes. We need to pay some attention if we decide to go down that road. But logically, you're correct, I believe.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Rose? Thank you very much. If not, we'll... Kelly will handle it.
Thank you. Yeah, don't give it to the chair.
I'd like to thank you all very much, and with that, we'll close the hearing on House Bill 3187. We're going to hear more of what?
Open all your transportation.
Okay.
We'll hear that testimony. Close that. And open here.
Okay. We're going to, because we have some logically grouped, and I assume some testimony that is logical, we're going to group House Bill 3178, House Bill 3185, House Bill 3164, House Bill 3173, and we'll hear opponents and proponents in that order. Those, and so with that, we will open the hearing on the four transportation bills. And first we will call, I don't see any representatives here. How many of you are...
And we'll talk on transportation if they had to.
Okay, let's have Deborah set the stage. Deborah Lincoln, would you give us your testimony first? What's that? And Deborah, let me ask you first, if we handle all four at one time, does that make it complicated?
Not a bit, sir.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Deborah Lincoln. I'm with the Department of Education, and my primary responsibility is people transportation. And I'm here today and want to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you to oppose all of the bills. And my number one concern is safety of students, and I forgot to give me. And I have a little flyer of information here that is going to be passed out to you. And the first thing I'd like to let you know is that National Highway Traffic Safety Administration says that school buses are the safest form of ground transportation. So I've provided you with some facts. These are national facts that 25 million children across the United States do not ride the school bus to school each day, and there are 448 fatalities as passengers and with a teen driver, and there's 169 fatalities with an adult driver, 131 as pedestrians, and 46 as bicyclists. Then you compare those numbers to the 25 million children who ride the school bus to and from school, and we lose approximately 5 children inside the school bus annually and 15 as a pedestrians at school bus stops. So the question I would want to propose to you is, how should we have Oregon children get to school? We want them to be on the safest form of transportation. And Oregon's safety record is just as good as the national figures. We haven't had a fatality inside an Oregon school bus since 1976 at the Lafayette train bus crash, in which we had 3. And in fact, those are the only 3 fatalities that we've ever had in the state of Oregon since we've been keeping statistics. No fatalities are acceptable, of course. We want the safest form of transportation. And just a little bit of history. It was approximately in the late 1980s that transportation did become mandatory by statute.
I believe all of the bills address the funding issue.
Correct.
Are you headed there?
I'm headed there.
Thank you.
And some of the bills also addressed the abolishment of transportation, the requirement to provide transportation. And so that's why my focus is more on safety, too. I would hate to see transportation be removed. I just grabbed the stack. I can find where it says that specifically. Some of them do away with it, and some of them don't. And I was going to say, in the late 1980s, the legislature decided that they needed to mandate transportation because school districts were holding transportation service over parents' heads. And they would say that we're not going to provide transportation unless you pass this bond. So it was at that time that the legislature felt it was in the best interest of kids in attendance that we would require transportation. So, of course, if we did away with transportation, there would be increased traffic, there would be some real hardship on poor or rural communities, and even within metropolitan areas, if working parents or poor parents couldn't provide transportation, then their kids may not get to school. I'm going to let Brian Reeder addressed some of the financial. My concern is any reduction of transportation I don't think is in the best interest of children, whether it's either reducing funding or reducing or removing transportation requirements. Thank you.
Thank you. Vice Chair Dahlem, members of the committee, my name is Brian Reeder. I'm with the Policy Research Office at the Department of Education. Want to talk a little bit about the financial aspects of these four bills. 3164, 3173, and 3178 all set the transportation grant amount in the aggregate to be the lesser of the current year or the prior year. And as a practical matter, because transportation costs go up over time, what those provisions do is essentially set that amount where it is in, since they all take effect July 1st of 05, they would set that grant amount to be the 04-05 level, and it would be unlikely that that amount would ever go up because that will always be the lesser of the 2 years compared. What that means is 10 years from now we will still be giving out $200 million in transportation grants, even though transportation costs may be two or three times what they are today. Effectively, that phases out, although not entirely, but as a practical matter over long periods of time, phases out completely or close to completely the transportation grant. And that effectively defeats the purpose of those grants as they were initially devised, and that was to give added resources to districts that have very high transportation costs. So the policy choice here is, are we going to continue to provide extra resources to those districts who have high transportation costs, which are costs really outside their control, or are we going to, or are we not going to do that? And, you know, I think the primary argument there is, and I believe we saw this prior to the current formula, and that is that districts with very high transportation costs, by paying those costs, really were shortchanging the classroom. They, in essence, high transportation costs sucked money out of the classroom and left those districts at a disadvantage. That was the purpose of the grant, and the problem it was designed to solve still exists. That problem has not gone away. The fourth bill, 3185, effectively converts the grant to a per ADMR amount, same amount per student in every district, and again defeats the purpose of the grant as it was initially conceived, and that is to get additional resources to where costs are high. So all of these bills, in essence, punish districts, primarily small rural districts, that have high transportation costs. And the department's view is if you can't get kids to school, you can't educate them. And if you have to spend extraordinary amounts to get them to school and that reduces the amounts that are available for instructional purposes, then you don't do those kids any favors. You leave them worse off. So we would oppose all four of these bills.
Thank you very much. Do we have any questions for either Brian or Deborah?
I think they summed it up very succinctly.
Any other statements for Brian or Deborah?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for coming over and taking your time. Michael Shields.
Hi, gentlemen. Mr. Chairman, committee members, Michael Shields, Salem-Keizer School Transportation Director. I also represent the South Willamette Oregon People Transportation Association, which encompasses, if you would imagine, the territory south of Woodburn to both the Idaho border and the coast south. So a large number of segments of districts. So the House bills, 3164, 3173, 3178, and 3185, financially impact children. Number one, the parents that we deal with desire more transportation rather than less. The one bill that reduces the funding from 70% to 60% in Salem-Keizer alone would impact us $900,000. That would mean an impact to the classroom because the parents would desire the same service level as they have now or more, and that would mean the districts would have to either look at less service level or and take that money out of the classroom, or they would have less service level and parents would have to have their kids walk farther, or they would have the same service level but less classroom monies. The rising cost of fuel on the bills that indicate that they would be based on this year, those fuel costs impact tires, batteries, belts, everything you can imagine are correlated to our fuel costs. So as rising fuel costs go up, so do those. So reducing that funding, again, it essentially impacts the classroom. When we're looking at, it said that some of those funds could be used to help maintain or sustain other classroom programs. Well, that's a one-year deal because the program is then based on the next year, and so you'd only have that funding available 1 year. The if we were to put students in the position of some of those where it looks like transportation would essentially be phased out over a period of time because of the reduction in service levels, either students end up having to walk farther, which means the whole one of the committees in our local community, Salem-Keizer Area Transportation, SCATS, and they look at ways to move more people for less money and less congestion. So what we have is mass transit doesn't serve all our community, so then that provides an impact on those students out there. We have ecology impacts because then more parents would drive their cars. There's congestion issues. We have working parents. Then we deal with the new No Child Left Behind bill, where schools are required to meet certain educational increases. Well, with that bill, attendance is part of it. And so if children don't have a safe ride to school, as Deborah Lincoln's already addressed the safety portions of that, then we have the issues with will kids come to school and how will they get there if they don't have their parents a ride because the parents have to work. We have special education issues that are mandated by law to provide service for kids with unique needs. And are those addressed? And the legal requirements that we face for kids to have that education and the kids that don't have the resources to provide their transportation. I would just put before the committee that perhaps if efficiencies are sought, that perhaps a committee of transportation and business professionals examine methods and approaches for the next session. So if we make decisions midstream, it has impacts that we're not able to recompense now. So thank you. For the record, Michael Shields.
Do we have any questions? In the Salem-Keizer district, is a point. How, the bus tries to come how close to a student's home? How far is a student walking, those that walk through?
0.25.
Thank you very much.
You bet.
If there are...
No, sir.
I don't think there are any further questions. Thank you very much.
That's all for.
Is there anyone else that would like to address the transportation bills? Harvey Matthews.
Mr. Chair, shall I come up with this? I'm also signed up for this.
Shall
I wait for comment?
You may join Harvey. Yeah. I might be trying to do a little too much here all at one time.
Could be.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. We're a public sector union representing nearly 20,000 classified and certified educators in Oregon's Head Start, K-12, ESD, and community colleges, including school bus drivers in districts all over the state. And I'm here today to oppose all four of the transportation bills. I know that you have a great large agenda, and I will try to be very brief. I will say that we wholeheartedly agree with everything that both Deborah Lincoln and the employee from the Department of Education, I'm sorry, Brian, said to you about student safety being there is no safer place for a student to be in when he's trying to get from one place to another than a school bus. That is safer than cars, walking, bicycles, or any other mode of transportation.
Or
deliberately
the school,
so.
Or the school bus themselves.
They're probably safer in the bus than they are in the school. That's right, Representative. That is deliberately so. The national government, through the National Highway Safety Transportation Safety Administration, has established safety standards for school buses that prevent children, that provide you the kind of safety statistics that Ms. Lincoln provided to you earlier. The reason that children are not being killed in school buses is because of the way school buses are constructed and because of the high professionalism of the drivers of those school buses. These bills will, the transportation reimbursement formula, let me start there. The transportation reimbursement formula is a reimbursement formula because the legislature has recognized that transportation costs, a great deal of transportation costs, are fixed costs or are costs beyond the control of the district. The district cannot decide where children live, how often they move, how much gasoline and diesel costs, and all of the associated costs that come from those things. They can decide how many managers it takes to run the bus barn, and if that's the efficiency you're looking at, my members would like to help with that as well. These bills do not reach toward efficiency. These bills destroy the transportation system that exists in schools today. If districts do not have the money to provide adequate transportation to students, then they're going to have to take the money out of the classroom. If they don't do that, then they're not going to provide adequate transportation. This is a Sophie's choice you don't want districts to make. You need children in school, and you need them to get there in the safest way possible, and that's the school bus. So we would encourage you, we would urge you to please recognize a good thing when you see one. Our transportation mandate and the reimbursement formula is exactly that. So thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Harvey? We'll
thank you, Chair Dillon. Harvey Matthews from Associated Oregon Industries. My comments are written down there. I'll just go through them briefly. We think that decreasing the transportation grant has the potential undesirable effect of disproportionately affecting Oregon's rural communities. Rural school districts' budgets are greatly influenced by the transportation grant, as you know, and largely due to the size of their service area. And because these rural school budgets are generally less than their larger valley counterparts, a cut to their transportation budget would result in a deeper cut to their overall school budget relative to their suburban and urban counterparts. So because few school districts outside the Willamette Valley have access to public transportation as a backup to their school busing system, AOI is concerned that students in rural areas will not consistently attend school or their parents' work schedules would be unduly interrupted. If the committee chooses to move House Bill 3164 or the other bills that affect the school district transportation grant funding, we'd strongly urge a provision within those to protect small and rural districts that don't have access to public transportation. Thanks for continuing to hear the creative solutions to increase the amount of K-12 money that goes towards the classroom instruction, and we stand beside you in that effort. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Matthews. Any questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So from your comment there that any other bill, and I assume these other three bills, which negatively affect all school districts, you also oppose those then generally?
yes, we're concerned about the rural issues there. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Lim.
Yes, this is the 4 bills concerning their transportation. What's the reason behind to try to do, introduce this bill? Do you give me a comment why this will happen to be?
I think as the chairman, I believe that we had several, we had a package of bills and some that we wanted vetted, and we put through quite a number of bills a month ago.
Yes, sir.
And this was part of that package, and the idea was to get public testimony, and
Gotcha.
I believe the notions came from a myriad of places.
Okay.
So you're not advocating to cut back on rural transportation?
I'm advocating to listen to what these people have to say and advocate or don't advocate later.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Are there any more people that would care to speak on transportation? I think they're friends. If not, we will close the public hearing.
Anyone?
Laura, pardon me.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, for not speaking up sooner. I wasn't quite sure whether my testimony is more... I'm Lori Wimmer Whalen with the OEA, by the way. Whether my testimony was more about this or more global, really, about the various bills before you today. So with your indulgence, I'd like to address them all. The transportation bills are certainly a subset of that. The 43,000 members of the Oregon Education Association do welcome this committee's review of the distribution formula, and your interest in school funding is acknowledged and appreciated. We reviewed the package of bills that you've just referred to, and we believe that it's an opportunity to contribute to a conversation about ways to improve the way we divide up our pot of school funding, whatever that level might ultimately be in this biennium or any other. We believe, most of all, that the distribution formula is pretty misunderstood, not only in this building, but out in the real world, among the public, and even among educators. Some people think that it rewards certain subgroups of folks in the education community. Some people think it's a line item spending directive. Some people think it's even a way to create more money. It's none of those things, of course. The distribution formula is meant to take whatever the appropriation is, equalize among the school districts based on local property wealth, and also account for those, as you've heard, uncontrolled costs that may exist in one district relative to another, so that the pot itself can be divvied up more fairly. Simply put, it doesn't create money, it doesn't reward and punish, it doesn't in any other way create some of these spending mandates that some people presuppose. I'd like to give you an example from that bill package before you, and it's not the transportation formula bills, although I'll address those as well. The teacher experience factor bill, which is House Bill 3166, the teacher experience factor is an example of the mathematical computation in the formula that's designed to more fairly distribute these resources. An average is determined, and that's redetermined as the average changes with the demographic changes in Oregon, and that's the bright line against which all districts are compared in terms of the demographics of their own teacher pool. That's how many years they've taught. So some districts will, in fact, get $25 a head more above that line, and some will get less. Now, that bill assumes that there creates, from that activity, a pot of money for teacher experience, to reward teacher experience. That's not the fact. I spoke just this afternoon with Steve Meyer in Legislative Revenue, and he explained to me that the amount of money that one would net for the successful schools program as envisioned in the bill is, if not zero, virtually zero. Because all you're doing, again, is taking the state school fund, whatever it is, and distributing it according to the demographics district to district. So this will be an example, in my opinion, of how the distribution formula is often misunderstood to some degree.
We have, at the OEA, traditionally regarded proposals to change the formula with some caution. I believe that there are times when a review of the formula makes sense as things change or as we want to tweak it to make it more accurate or more fair or more reflective of those uncontrolled costs I spoke of. But it's also true that some folks have understood it to be a possible way to bring more money into their district at the expense of others. In Congress, they call that pork barreling. We certainly don't support the latter, but we do support the former type of review. And so those kinds of proposals we have backed in the past. There's a new, I would say, inclination reflected in some of the distribution formula proposals I've seen this session, different from in the past. And that presupposes, I guess, a mistrust of what the formula is doing, like it's hiding money, the creation of the term phantom students rather than weighted students would be an example of what I saw in that. We would not share that mistrust of the formula's intent. And again, if there's a way to improve upon the way it distributes funds, that's one thing. But we don't believe that weighting does anything more than creates a mathematical formula for helping us more fairly distribute that money. Finally, there are those who would morph the formula into a spending mandate. And that, by that I mean whatever the cost drivers are that you calculate in the formula, that you shall have a thou shalt language that requires that that precise dollar amount go to fund that specific program. That, of course, would wipe out local control. We think that local communities can best determine and assess, based on priorities and issues in their own district, how to build their budgets and manage the money they're sent by the state, and that that ought to be the way that continues to operate, and that this not the, the formula ought not morph into that kind of mandate. As I said, though, it doesn't mean that I think or that OEA thinks that the formula is perfect as it is, and if this, products of this hearing today would be some sort of work group or some sort of endeavor to look at the distribution formula in the future, we would certainly welcome an opportunity to participate in that because we, as I said, would agree that there are times when reviews are merited. In fact, we've done so in past biennia. That's how we've looked at special education costs. We've looked at the needs of small schools. We've looked at regional cost factors, facilities costs, and so on, and we have made improvements based on those looks. So with respect to the specific bills before you, we did have some concerns about each and every one of them, and I'd be happy to outline those for you if you'd like, although I don't want to duplicate the fine testimony of those who came before me. I could say that we echo many of their concerns. Thank you.
I would like to close the hearing on transportation if we're done. And then come back to Lori on general questions about all of the bills. Is there anyone that would like to speak to transportation specifically? If not, we will close the hearing on House Bill 3178, 3185, 3164, and 3173. And with that, we will open the hearing on House Bill 2650, 2727, 3166, 2989, and 2990. And I now open that hearing. And with that, Lori, I think your comments pertain mostly, certainly to all of the bills, but to that group in general. Would you have any more to add? And then I will open it for questions to these.
All righty, Mr. Chair. Let me see if there's anything in particular I feel like I need to outline for you. Well, I think the example I gave you in my previous testimony about House Bill 3166 in particular is just an important point for you to understand. One of the things about that bill is that it proposes that the money that is anticipated to be saved by removing the teacher experience factor as a weight. As I've already said, there probably isn't any money to be found there, but even if there were, the idea is that would be applied to the successful schools program. Well, I had the opportunity to help create that program back in 1997. It was the good part of Senate Bill 880 that passed that year. Some of you were around, you'll remember. It was a bill that was based on what local communities and local school districts determined constituted success by a broad array of measures, not a single measure. And that way schools could, in theory, compete for this up to $1,000 grant for the purpose of applying it for professional development or field trips for the kids or other kinds of rewards for being designated as a successful school by those local measures. This bill changes that and changes it to being those who accomplish according to NCLB measures, so we would have concerns about changing that part of the law. And as I said, I don't think there is any money that would be funding the Successful Schools program based on my conversation with Mr. Meyer. And finally, we think that the teacher experience factor is a fairer way to distribute the resources. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Are there any questions? Thank you very much. Ted Piper.
Chair Dahlin, members of the committee, I want to thank you for holding this hearing on House Bill 2989 for the record. My name is Ted Piper. I'm the legislative assistant for Representative Betty Comp, representing House District 22, testifying on her behalf in support of House Bill 2989 as she is out on a field trip for another committee. House Bill 2989 directs school districts to categorize budget expenditures that correlate to the weighted factor distributions. The key weighting factors are special education, second language learners, students in poverty, and students in the criminal justice system. The No Child Left Behind Act requires districts to track all program design and management in these categories. Not all districts fall under the NCLB requirements, which results in lack of consistency of reporting funds to the State Department of Education. Technology in use today makes this requirement very easy for schools to implement. The record systems are becoming ever more sophisticated, and the codes are already in place. The process of reporting is a matter of aligning funding codes in a set way for a clear and consistent distribution table. All communities demand accountability, and until we make reporting documents understandable and readable, the public will always encounter a fog of unknown factors that affect educational programs and schools in a way that average people find difficult to understand. As for your immediate support of this bill, we can no longer wait to gain data to make excellent and thoughtful decisions regarding public education. This time, I suppose I'll document questions for Representative Comp that I can give to her when she gets back, as these bills are fairly complicated. I'm not sure if I'll be able to give you the answers you need, if any questions exist.
We'll see if we can drum up some questions for you to take back to the big representative.
Or we could send some later, too.
Are there any questions for Representative Comp that we might want answered? I think that the Bolton bill is fairly straightforward.
Okay.
And we will certainly get back with a good representative.
And can I testify on 2989? Okay.
Yes, you can, Ted.
Okay, again, for the record, my name is Ted Piper, Legislative Assistant to Representative Betty Comp, here to urge support for House Bill 2990. This bill is a foundation bill built to stabilize school funding. Currently, most parents and teachers, community members, have difficulty in understanding just how much funding a school district receives. The media focuses on the general funding received by the states, and many do not realize the amount or number of total funding sources of school districts. House Bill 2990 requires districts to list total revenues as part of the accountability report card that is mailed to every parent and school children in the state. Also declared on the report card is the total district student enrollment number of staff members. The current practice is to list all certified teachers. Many people think that these numbers create an accuracy picture to show how many students are in the classrooms and being taught by certified teachers. The reality is that it does not. Some certified teachers are not assigned to students, such as librarians, counselors, or specialists. House Bill 2990 would require separate accounting for teachers in classrooms and those who are not. The purpose is for collaborative community involvement in making decisions for educational programs. When parents and community partners are analyzing revenues and expenditures, they can easily calculate exactly what are the student-to-teacher ratios and the costs involved. With two additional components added to the state report card, credible discussion can begin. For too many years, the figures and computations have only been locked in business offices of the school districts. It is time to create clear, understandable figures for public education. Our taxpayers deserve to know that our schools are being held accountable. Until the information is easily accessed, doubts will remain. I ask for your support of House Bill 2990.
Again, I would ask the committee, are there any questions that we would like to take back to Representative Cohn? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tricia Smith. Go ahead, Tricia.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, and I am here today to testify in opposition to House Bill 2727. House Bill 2727 would place a prohibition in the statutes that would prohibit school districts from using state school fund monies to help support their school lunch or breakfast programs. In talking to one of the sponsors of the bill, when I first read this bill, I thought, well, I bet there's more to this story than the bill. And sure enough, my understanding is the point of this bill is to encourage districts to make their food service programs self-sufficient. And that's an admirable goal. In fact, many of the food service programs in school districts throughout the state are self-sufficient, and some actually make money for their school districts. We have members who are working in some school districts, some in East Multnomah County, for example, that are very proud of the business that they have created in their kitchens that caters to outside organizations and businesses, and they actually make money for their school district. When that can happen, that's fabulous, and our members are very happy to participate in that. Unfortunately, we have school districts big and small in this state and in a wide variety of communities. Some communities can support the kinds of activities that a school kitchen could create as a business model. Some communities cannot. It requires a pretty healthy economy to support a catering business, and that's essentially what we're talking about here. And some communities are just too small. Those communities rely on the school lunch and breakfast programs in their schools to help feed their kids. There are way too many hungry kids in Oregon. I know that you have heard plenty of news stories and plenty of testimony about Oregon being one of the hungriest states in the nation for children. If you have a hungry child in your classroom, it's very difficult to teach him. The school breakfast and lunch program was instituted because of that fact. It is a program that is primarily financed with federal and other funds, and in those districts where they must supplement that program a bit by their state school fund, we would hate to see this bill pass and prevent those districts from doing so. That can only result in hungry children, and we would hope that that would not happen. So with that in mind, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Do you have any questions? Thank you again for your testimony. Ed Johnson.
Good afternoon. My name is Ed Johnson. I'm from Toledo, Oregon. And I have some concerns with the bills. Eliminating, I want to go to 2727. Dealing with eliminating state funds for school lunch programs, to me that's a dangerous, dangerous thing. Because in 10, 15 years, let's say the federal dollars decrease to a point, we eliminate this, we're going to be back here in 10 or 15 years, going right through this again. If we really want to sit there and help out these kids in schools, why aren't we taking the bycatch off these boats out in the ocean that are throwing these dead fish back over and making sure that food gets into our school systems or the rest of it to food share? If we really have concerns, let's make sure it works correctly on the balance of our environment and ecosystem instead of just sitting there wasting food. These are our resources, and we constantly think we have the right to just waste them and destroy them. So I'm very concerned with that one being passed, because what are we doing to the future? And that's the one thing that we really have to be concerned. You know, I'm not a public official. I'm just a citizen. That I do see things that gets really frustrating. And by doing that, we're setting ourselves for devastation down the road. And I believe that will happen on that bill there. 2650. I'm sort of concerned about the eliminating the AED M&W, because part of that formula was one that really helped me in Lincoln County when I did the Lincoln County recall in the Lincoln County School Board. You know, I still would like to see the investigation or possible indictment of the budget down there, what happened. That's the reason why Lincoln County residents recalled the entire school board. We want to know what happened to the money that was shifted out of the fund. You know, I mean, I've turned in those papers on the Senate floor where there was lots of money that was unaccounted for, and during transactions of bank statements, the money was missing per transaction. So, I mean, how are we going to do a research or keep an accurate count of our funding if we eliminate that? Well, the formulas, because the formulas does help, and if we eliminate the formulas, what are we going to come up with this type of solution for the next one? At least the formulas have been actually working, to my understanding, and there's people who argue on both sides. But until we actually come up with a correct solution, we can't eliminate something until we have a solution to the problem. 2990. That's another one that concerns me, especially with the performance of school student behavior in this bill, because that's monitoring like with school surveys. School surveys are a tragedy in this state, and I'll publicly say that, and I have many times. Refers to Senate Bill 26 in 1999. The school surveys were definitely used in this state as with the services children and family used, and said it was anonymous callers. And because of intergovernment agency agreements with the school district, the services children and families get these school files. So those school files, when the kids answer these surveys and ask how many guns you got in your home, what your parents do, and ask what your neighbors do, ask very blunt questions. Well, most of the students were taking it as a joke, you know. I mean, most of them saying, yeah, of course I have sex 10 times a week. You know, it was a joke to them. But we sit there and put so much faith in a piece of paper that really doesn't mean nothing. So that is a very strong concern, because we already know the state agencies have abused the survey privilege, you know, and I would definitely like to see the Parents' Right to Know Act come back up, so the parents get a signature sheet before their kids do a survey and know the true facts and ramifications of what those surveys do.
Mr. Chair,
a question.
Thank you. Actually, just a comment. 2990 doesn't do any of those things. All it says is on the report card, the state would also report the amount of teachers in the classroom, not in the classroom, and the amount of funding and that sort of thing. It doesn't apply to surveys done by the districts.
I guess where I'm coming up at that point, maybe I'm probably misunderstanding this,
yeah,
which I don't have a problem with that, but okay, when it goes to student performance and student behavior.
Yeah. No,
okay, because I know with the behavior surveys they do in the schools, that to my understanding would affect that on the behavior surveys. Okay. Maybe I could be wrong. If I'm wrong, I do apologize.
Yeah.
But
it's the one done by the superintendent of education annually that comes out. That's what this one refers to.
But then I definitely have to agree with that, because that's sort of like a reprieve dealing with a recall of the school board, because the public needs to know where the money's being spent, and that's the one thing that, you know, we've had enough, like with our superintendent who, you know, bought a brand new motor coach and, you know, home in Hawaii, and we ended up getting him out, and he ended up with one heck of a pension after doing a lot of things and taking money out of Lincoln County. But no, if it's in that direction, then the other point, then what I misunderstood, then definitely 100% on that, because the public definitely needs to know where the money is going, and we're constantly being misled. And so definitely that would, if that's the direct question, I misunderstood. Yeah. I definitely support a due pass for that one.
Okay. You are in support of 2990.
Yes. Thank you
very much. Is there anyone else that would wish to testify to any of these formula changing bills? If not, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2650, House Bill 2727, House Bill 3166, House Bill 2989, and House Bill 9990. And with that, I believe the business for the day is completed, and we will adjourn the committee.
One more time.
Thank you very much.